X cross Y exists. So that, what does it mean? It means that we have X cross Y, and we have two morphisms which come with the definition of the product. So what we need to come up with, cook up, are these other two morphisms. And then we have to see that they satisfy these identities. So how do we come up with I1? Well, remember, from if you look at what happens in reality, that is, if you're dealing with actual modules, abelian groups, or what have you, what do we want I1 to be? Well, we want it to be the identity here, and we want it to be the zero morphism here. Yes? So in other words, define I1 as the unique morphism from X to X cross Y such that the first projection onto I1 is the identity on X, and the second one, the second projection on I1 is zero. Now, because we say the product exists, we know that for each pair of morphisms there exists a unique one, so we know that I1 is unique. And notice that this gives us one for free, and it gives us, moreover, the what we embedded into the proof as a first statement. It gives us that the wrong projection combined with an injection is zero. So, and then, of course, by duality, so similar, you get I2. So now, what do we need to prove? So the only thing to check is to check 3. Well, how do we check 3? We simply have to show that if you take the identity from X cross Y on the one side, and we take the left-hand side, so I1 P1 plus I2 P2, that they cannot be distinguished once you project onto the two factors. Not because of the uniqueness of the construction. Well, if you take the identity and project and combine with P1, we get P1. If you take the sum and combine it with P1, so we get P1, I1, P1, plus I2, P2, well, just look. P1, I1, we showed, is the identity, so this is going to be, so let's write it out. So we know this here is the identity on X by definition of I1, so this is P1, and again, by definition of I2, so looking at the other pair, this is 0. So in other words, we see that this morphism is also P1, if you apply the projection to the sum. And then, of course, by symmetry, we are done. So, in other words, if you have a product, it's automatically a direct sum. And so, in the pre-additive category, these three things coincide, the three notions. This implies, in particular, that the additive structure is unique, as follows from the next observation, And this is often used the other way around. In other words, what I'm going to write down now as a sort of as a proposition is often used as a definition. So for morphisms FF prime from X to Y, one has the following expression for the sum of the two, namely F plus F prime. So let's see how it works. So what you want to say is we take the direct product of the two morphisms. Think of it as a direct product or direct coproduct or direct sum. These are functorial, so if I have a morphism on the first factor and a morphism on the second, it induces one either on the product or coproduct, whichever you like. On the other hand, if I identify this with X cross X, then there is a diagonal map. And so the diagonal map is a unique map into X cross X, which has a property, if you take the two projections, that it induces the identity. So because X cross X is a product, there exists a unique diagonal morphism. Now, dually, there exists a codiagonal, sometimes also called the sum map. I don't know. There is no standard notation for this. I'll just use delta upper Y. And so the claim is that F plus F prime is equal to the composition you have here. So in other words, it's delta Y composed with F direct sum F prime composed with the diagonal on X. And so you see, this says that the additive structure is purely given in terms of categorical data. It does not involve any choices. So here, maybe I should have, for symmetry, I should have inserted here that this is the same as a coproduct, and any coproduct admits a canonical codiagonal, which is the dual picture of this one down here. So that's the argument why the additive structure is unique. Now, how do we prove this? Well, again, it's just a simple matter of putting in the right things at the right places. So I think I should leave myself somewhat more space, so I'll draw the diagram over here. Because I think it is much more confusing to see it sort of in a line editor than to see the whole picture, which is much easier to understand. So the first thing is we insert at this stage the identity on X cross X or X plus direct sum X. So we write this as delta Y F plus F prime, and then we write, it's over there still, I1 P1 plus I2 P2 comprised as delta X. And so this here takes place on X plus X. Maybe I'll just write it as an index to make sure we understand where this happens. Now, so just keep that diagram over there. So we have delta X here. So here we have the projection, say, on the first factor and the injection, the projection onto the second and the injection. Here we have F and F prime. So here we have the projection and the injection and same here. And then the co-diagonal to what? So, all I've done, I've taken the whole composition and I have inserted these maps here. Now, what is F plus F prime composed with I1, P1? Well, I claim that's the same thing as F. So, I claim that this thing here is the same. So, if I look at F composed with this, it's just going to be I1F. So, that's a map into Y plus Y plus I2F prime. And again, note that P1 delta X is the identity on X, a definition of the diagonal. So, finally, we'll just see that the co-diagonal on I1 is going to be the identity on Y. So what this is simply the identity times F plus the identity times F prime. So this is simply F plus F prime. So what it uses, the key step is, of course, from here to here, is just the functoriality of the construction, using that either both are products or both are co-products to get the right functoriality. So, corollary, as I said, if A is a pre-additive category in which any pair of objects has a product equivalently a co-product, and make sure you understand that it's not meant that you either want, right? You're given two objects, either you have all the time the product or you have all the time a co-product, then the additive structure, the pre-additive structure, is unique. And that's why often you see when one goes the other way around. When first asks if products and co-products exist, that they coincide, then one establishes that it is a direct sum. In other words, one has this split diagram with the PIs, IIs, and then one verifies by hand that this formula defines the right kind of additive structure. So it satisfies the right properties. So that's fairly typical as far as this kind of arguments is concerned. One consequence of this, and this is also a very useful fact, so assume, I'll just very loosely say, so assume A is pre-additive with finite, well, I say with direct sums. Now, just mean two objects, not more. I mean, if you have two, of course, then you have finitely many, but I'm not allowing direct sums yet of infinitely many objects. And by the way, just in case you're not aware of it, but even in the most benign additive category, like the category of the Abelian groups, it is false that the infinite coproduct and the infinite product are isomorphic. Right? Sorry? Products are, as I explained last time, they're unique up to unique isomorphism because they're characterized, they represent a certain functor. Any two objects representing the same functor are canonically isomorphic. There's a unique isomorphism. Yeah? Maybe I should make this more precise, right? So if you have a functor, so a pre-sheaf, say, and you have an isomorphism from a representable functor and another one from another representable functor, then there exists a unique isomorphism here. Yes? Of course, the isomorphism from X, from HX, from the functor represented by X to F, they can be moved around by the automorphisms of X. Right? If you have one isomorphism, then you get another one by combining it with the automorphism of X. Doesn't change the properties. But once you fix the isomorphism to the functor, then everything becomes unique up to unique isomorphism. Yeah? Sort of a tricky thing. One has to understand, which always, for example, comes up in moduli problems, where you have this situation. You have objects with lots of automorphisms potentially, but you have to rigidify them. So in other words, you fix one to your given object. And here, in the case of representable functors, it comes with the territory to say that an object represents a functor is not just to give the object, it's also to give this isomorphism. And mind you, this isomorphism is some specific element in f of x by Yoneda's lemma. Yeah? So one could say, so this is just a review, one can say so that representable functor f is two things. It's an object x plus an element alpha in f of x. Both things belong together. It's not good enough to just give the object x itself. Yeah? Does that refresh your memory? All right. So where was I? So assume A is pre-additive as direct sums of two objects. Where did I want to go from here? Oh, yes. Actually, I want two of these. And F from A to B is a functor. So, sorry, I should A and B are pre-additive. So I have two pre-additive functors, categories, both have direct sums. And let's F from A to B be a functor. Then the following are equivalent. And that's a functor which satisfies these conditions called F is an additive functor. First, for any objects X, Y in A, the induced map from HOM A X Y to HOM B F X F Y, so which takes a morphism from X to Y and maps it to its image under the functor, so is a group homomorphism. So this is something which in general would be relatively cumbersome to prove. However, the easier one is F preserves products
of two objects.
And then, well, you can easily think what comes next. F preserves coproducts. F preserves direct sums. The last three equivalences are, of course, a little bit overdoing it, because product and coproduct and direct sums are the same in both categories, so 2, 3, and 4 are immediately equivalent. But that is usually quite easy to check, and it might come from a priori reasons that your functor preserves either products or coproducts. It might come with the territory. And then you know immediately that it has to preserve the additive structure. And the reason is, again, this formula here. Because if you apply your functor F, and so let me give you a quick proof. It says simply apply F to, if you like, the defining equation, delta upper y, f direct sum f prime, direct sum delta x. And note that if you take f of delta code, let's say the codiagonal on y, this is necessarily, if f preserves coproduct, is the same as the codiagonal on f of y, and so forth. And so if f preserves direct sums, then it maps f direct sum f prime to f of f direct sum f of f prime, and the same, and the formula shows you it's a homomorphism. All right. Now here is I want to give you two comments on the distinction between realizations of these concepts, which do not work quite as well for abelian categories. So here's sort of Gabriel's realization of small pre-additive categories. And this is sort of the first. This was contained in his thesis in 1960-something, 62-1. And as I think I've mentioned it at the beginning of the course, was sort of that people didn't pay any attention to, really, until it was rediscovered, well, for one thing, by Mitchell in 1970 in a paper in the Advances called Rings with Several Objects. But then again, nobody paid any attention. And it only came back quite recently through various venues that I explained at the very beginning. There's A, representation theory, infinite dimensional representations of Galois groups, and that's work of Faltings and Ofer Galois, which was done over the last 3 years, and then one of the proofs of the Stending main conjectures in commutative algebra for rings of dimension 3 by Heitmann, which uses the same thing. And also in functional analysis, more precisely in the theory of C star algebra, suddenly this is all the rage, even though it's phrased quite differently. So what is he doing? Well, the key is, so if A is a small pre-additive category, then the Gabriel ring, and this is a ring without identity, so I'll drop the I, is simply the following object. It's R of A, and mind you, to be able to write this down, I need that the category is small. In other words, the objects form a set so that I can index over them. So we simply take the direct sum over all the abelian groups of all possible homomorphisms. And addition is component-wise, addition. And how do we multiply? Well, by distributivity, I simply need to say, if I have two morphisms, how do I multiply? Well, obviously, if I can compose them, I'll take the composition. So if the domain of F equals the codomain, or the range, or whatever you want to call it, codomain of G, i.e., if F and G are composable. And what do you do if they are not? Well, remember when I did this for arbitrary small categories with magmas, we had to artificially throw in a new element to make sense out of the composition of things that couldn't be composed before. Here we don't have to do that because we always have sort of a throwback. We always can declare things to be zero. However, this muddies the water because there are too many zeros around. Still, this is a definition, but the trick, or the slight inconvenience is, it is now no longer possible from this ring to reconstruct the category. However, it's not such a big loss. Indeed, it points to something else, which is all the rage these days, and that is sort of the so-called tilting theory. And I'll explain it to you in a moment, but let me first say so some properties. So first of all, R of A has a multiplicative unit, i.e. 1, only if the objects of A are finite, if the set of objects of A is finite. But it has something which is almost as good. There is a family of orthogonal idempotents, namely, we'll call them EX, which are just the elements in this ring which come from the identities on these objects. So X and A, and the objects of A. And what does it mean? Well, idempotent is clear, right? It means that EX composed with EX is EX. Orthogonal means that EX composed with EY is zero if X is not equal to Y, which is in conformity with the rule here, because the identity on one object is not composable with the identity on another object. And this family of orthogonal idempotents has the following properties, such that for every element, let me give it some name, A in R of A, the sets, and I'll just make this up, sort of the left support of A, which I'll define to be the set of all idempotents EX, such that EX times A is not zero, and the right support of A, which is, of course, the set of all idempotents EY, such that A times EY is not zero, both are finite. Well, no big surprise here. namely what is an element A in R of A. Well, by definition, A is the sum, the finite sum of some morphisms. So it's a sum of some morphisms, Fi, where let's say Fi is a morphism from Xi to Yi. And so you see that Ex, I should have switched X and Y there. Sorry. So you see that A times Ex is equal to Fi if X equals Xi and zero else. And similarly, Ey A is going to be Fi if Y equals Yi and zero else. Well, of course, no, this is too flippant. I should have said it's a summation over all Fi for all Xi that are equal to X, and similarly here, the summation of all Fi for all the I such that Yi equals Y. But so you see, there are only, because it's a finite sum, there are only finitely many objects that occur in here, and thus there are only finitely many idempotents that can not destroy A. But of course, this in itself, and why? What's the problem with reconstructing the category? Well, unless you specifically give the... Remember, when I showed you the structure theorem for small categories in general, there the idempotents were uniquely determined by the rest of the structure. Here this is no longer true. If I don't tell you what family of orthogonal idempotents I take, you might come up with different sets. For example, let's take the ring R, which is, say, Z cross Z. Well, I claim I can think of this clearly as the Gabriel ring of the classifying category of Z cross Z. So in other words, I'll take simply the category which has Z cross Z as its endomorphism ring. And because of the definition, there is only one homomorphism set, so this whole thing degenerates and you get this. On the other hand, it's also the ring where you take two objects. Sort of you take the direct product of the classifying category of Z twice. What's the distinction? Well, the distinction is that here, sort of the idempotent I use is just one, the multiplicative identity I have. What do I use here? Well, here I use 1, 0 and 0, 1. And both work. And that's in contrast to what happened earlier when we are looking at the set theoretic version of this. And so, I would suggest we'll have a small break then, and then I show you some of these examples in practice, and maybe over the break you can think of why. So Mitchell, in his paper which I referred to, he calls this, well, sort of this small pre-additive categories he calls rings with several objects. And the construction going from the category to the algebra, he calls R of A tic-tac-toe algebras. So I'll leave it to you to think about how could you come up with the name tic-tac-toe algebras for these algebras R of A. There's a real concrete meaning to this. Okay, let's have a 15-minute break. One would call these rings tic-tac-toe algebras. Well, here's the explanation. So remember, if we had a partially ordered set, that was the same thing. So then we had a classifying category for this. And these categories were characterized by the fact that for any two objects, X and Y, in this category C, it was either 0 or 1. So there was either one morphism or none. And there was one morphism if X is smaller or equal to Y, and none if they were not related. So then, following is sort of, in this particular example, not so difficult to understand, but it's again just a special case of a much more general construction. So first of all, you can make this pre-additive by replacing CXY with the free abelian group generated by X and Y, and that you can do for any category. So this here is a free abelian group generated by the set CXY, and remark if instead you take the free K module generated by the same set, then you get a K-linear structure. And of course, it's clear how composition works, right? It's clear how it works on the basis elements, and then by linearity, you know how to map multiples. So now, let's look at that. So let's assume if S smaller or equal is finite, then we can refine our partial ordering to linear ordering. Well, so then can refine to a linear ordering. I mean, that you can do well with, but so what does that mean? So you define a new order, so you choose a linear order, let's call it like this, so that such that A, it's linear. In other words, any two objects are compatible. And moreover, if S was smaller or equal to S prime, well, we should say it is a finite partial order. And so if S was smaller or equal than S prime in the old order, then it is still smaller or equal in the new order. And so the key is that then you can pick, you get a picture of the corresponding Gabriel ring, well, so here you have your object S1, S2, S3, let's say Sn, and remind you, these are all, this is linearly ordered. And then you just put a star, meaning that hum si sj is not zero and zero else. And so in the case of a preorder, what it means is sort of you have one copy of the integers or of your favorite ring K. So for example, you have stars on the diagonal. You have, in this case, you have zeros below the diagonal because there are only morphisms from smaller to larger ones, so only when you go from left to right. And over here, you have some holes and some stars. And so an element, so the star, you would think of the star as being K, si, sj. So an element in the Gabriel ring, is a matrix with entries from K with prescribed zeros, zero entries. And that's why it's called the tic-tac-toe algebra, right? And the multiplication is equal to the ordinary matrix multiplication. As you can easily check yourself. So that there is, that it is upper triangle comes just from the ordering, and then you have certain, you have zeros whenever the two objects were not comparable in the original order. So you can do, so for example, if you take the ring of all 3x3 upper triangle matrices, so what's the preorder which belongs to it? Well, obviously, any three, there is something from the first to the second, from the second to the third. So this is just the preorder, if you like, looks like this. It's a linear order. So the n by n upper triangular matrix ring is just the Gabriel ring, which belongs to a string of linear of length n, linearly ordered string of length n. Well, maybe I'll leave it to you. Let's say, so you just draw the Husser diagram of the preorder. So saying that an element is smaller if it sits on lower. So what would be the tic-tac-toe algebra that belongs to this preorder? How many holds would it have? Just one, right? Because it's only these two objects that are not compatible in the order. Comparable in the order. So you get a 4x4 matrix ring, upper triangular matrices with one hole. And then just convince yourself that indeed the multiplication respects the hole. Okay, so you can do your own examples. And of course, you can do this also if you don't want just upper triangular matrices. So if you start with a finite ordered graph, and you have morphisms going back and forth, so for example, what would be the Mitchell incarnation of this category? This is the same thing as all matrices. Yes. And so you can think for yourself, for example, what matrix algebra would correspond to the diagram where you remove, say, vertices. Now, of course, if you have more arrows, then the picture becomes slightly more convoluted because then here in this tic-tac-toe algebra, in their definition, the point was that the entry at each point was just one copy of the scalars. So you can think of this really, the elements really as being matrices with one element at all the permitted spots. Whereas if, for example, the endomorphism ring of S1 is larger, then the star would have to represent the endomorphism ring of S1. But you still can arrange it in this kind of matrix format, and the multiplication is still given by a normal matrix multiplication. This one here? Yeah, because you have four objects. Yeah, I said you have to choose a linear ordering just so that you can frame your matrix. So, for example, you would refine the ordering by saying, without destroying anything else, by, for example, inserting the extra relation that this one is, the left one is smaller or equal than the right one. Yeah? And so then, so this in your matrix, so the bottom piece would come first, and then you would have the left, right, and top. Right? And you would have a 4x4 matrix like this. And so I would just leave it up to you to figure out where the hole is. But of course, you could have chosen the other linear ordering, and that would have switched these two places. It's not really a big deal, but it's just a way how you translate from the picture into the matrices and back. Okay. Now it is interesting as well, so because it again it, so this is sort of a very simple construction, and it maybe it was considered to be too simple, but now let's look at our small category. Let's call it C, and we look at all functors from the small category C into the category, say, of all K modules, K some commutative ring. And now, how is this known by another name? What is such a thing? if the category, the small category is not too large, so that we can draw pictures. So let's say, as we did here, so we have a bunch of objects and we have morphisms. So what is a functor? What's the functor from this category, which I physically laid down as an oriented graph, the objects being the vertices, the arrows being the morphisms? What is a functor from here into K modules? Think of K your favorite field and K modules just K vector spaces. So what would it mean? Well, let's give names to these vertices. Let's number them 1, 2, 3, 4, whatever. And so what's a functor? Well, a functor would send each vertex I goes to some vector space we'll call VI, or K module. And an arrow, so an oriented edge, or arrow alpha, well, where does that go to? So here at the vertex 1, we had a vector space V1, V2, V3, V4, and now we have a morphism alpha. So what does the functor do? Well, the functor has to assign to it a morphism in the category of modules from what you have assigned at this vertex to what you had assigned at the target vertex. So in other words, this is going to be a k-linear map. We'll call, let's say, V of alpha, which goes from the vector space at the source of alpha, or sometimes also called the tail of alpha, to the vector space at the head of alpha. And of course, if there are some relations between these morphisms, like, for example, if, let's call this alpha, beta, gamma, delta, for example, if your category had the property that beta alpha was equal to gamma alpha, so in other words, didn't matter in the composition whether you take first alpha and then beta or first alpha and then gamma, well, then, of course, these relations have to be respected by the functor. So, relations among arrows go then to relations among the linear maps. So how do we call such a diagram? By another name? No, not necessarily, because there is no necessarily any commutation here. Nobody says that things come together again. No, not a complex. It's a curve representation, yes. So you think of this, the underlying category C, you think of it as a curve. Remember? A quiver is something where you keep your arrows in. That's why it's called that way. And so a functor into K mod is then called a K-linear quiver representation. Now, so a functor can be really, in this case, depicted quite easily by simply putting appropriate labels on all the pieces. Now, what's a morphism between two such representations? So in other words, now, what's a morphism between functors? So, morphisms between functors and morphisms of plural representations. Now, what is a morphism between functors? Well, if you have a functor V, as in this picture there, so which to a vertex or object of vertex assigns some vector space and to some morphism assigns a linear map, and we have another one . So what should be a morphism, or what is by definition a morphism of functors? Well, this consists of various pieces. It consists of morphisms, phi I, over each object, such that, and now comes Dorr, all the relevant diagrams commute. Right? So, if I had, let me draw just a piece of this here, say 1, 2, 3, here I have V1, V2, V3, and I have second copy with different vector spaces W1, W2, W3, and of course the morphisms would be V of alpha, W of alpha, etc. Then a morphism of functors would be given by a family of linear maps, phi 1, phi 2, phi 3, and so on, such that, so the phi I are K linear, and for each alpha, the diagram, well, we have V at the tail of alpha, we have W at the tail of alpha. Between them, we have phi at the tail of alpha. Then we have V of alpha, which is a morphism to V at the head of alpha. We have similarly a morphism W of alpha, which maps from the tail of alpha to the vector space of the head of alpha. And here we would have phi of H of alpha, and all of these diagrams have to commute. Yes? Now, for example, it is clear then what would be an isomorphism of representations. When would you call two representations isomorphic? In other words, when are the corresponding functors isomorphic? Well, we did this sort of some time ago, second lecture or so. Just means that all these phis have to be isomorphisms. Right? A morphism between functors is an isomorphism if and only if each individual piece is an isomorphism. One of the good things. So here, and this is where the whole quiver stuff comes from, here are two examples, home exercise. Classify all isomorphism classes of quiver representations of the type of the following types. In the first case, I have four objects and sort of one central vertex where the other three go into, and I want representations sort of where I prescribe the dimension vector. So the dimension vector of a representation is simply the collection, the dimension of VI for all I in the objects of C. So the dimension vector I want to prescribe is dimension 1 on the outside, dimension 2 on the inside. And so, trivial representations into your favorite vector spaces. So K should be just a field. Doesn't really matter. So what do you get here? And the other question is, if you do the same thing, but now you have four things going in. And again, the dimension on the outside are all one, and in the center there it's two. So, maybe I'll take 3 minutes to discuss this. So for example, so what is the representation of the left piece here? Well, you give three one-dimensional vector spaces, and for each of them, in the center you give a two-dimensional vector space, and so you give linear maps. Now, from a one to a two-dimensional vector space, you can write this, say, as a vector like this, assuming you have chosen bases, right? And now up to isomorphism, what should be the classes? Now clearly, for example, it can happen if you have a degenerate situation. Say this map is zero. Then there is this space has nothing to do with this space. Similarly, the other two could be zero. So that there are some degenerate cases. What's the generic case? Well, the generic case is where none of these is zero. Well, and then you run into, so what is then, what is the geometric picture that we are looking at really here? Well, first let's note that if these three are non-zero, that means that the morphism of vector spaces is an injection, right? Because that's to say that these linear maps have rank 1. But that's the same to say that we give three vectors in the plane. Or if you like, three lines in the plane. And the question is, what is the normal form for three lines in a plane? Because remember, you're still allowed automorphisms of this space here. So what's the normal form for three lines in a plane? Huh? Yeah, 3 points on the projective line. Or, if you like, you can always normalize it like this, right? 0, 1, infinity. Think of the slopes as the points in P1. So in other words, there are some degenerate ones, and then there's one generic case only. What happens here? So that's the question, taking aside the degenerate cases. We have four lines in the plane. Well, what's the parameter for four lines in the plane? Well, we can certainly take three of them and map them like this, but what happens then to the fourth one? Do you have any more choices? No. And what do you call the slope of the fourth one? If you send the first one to this, the second one to this, the third one to this. Yeah, it's a cross ratio. It's a cross ratio of the four slopes that is the parameter of the isomorphism class of the representation. So suddenly, for four subspaces, you have a continuous parameter, the cross ratio. Whereas here you have a discrete situation. All right? And that's where this whole trivial business comes from, trying to understand the so-called four-subspace problem, namely, so this was the easy one, where we had sort of can draw a picture. Now assume you allow arbitrary dimensions here. So instead of looking at three lines in the plane, you look at some vector space, might be very big, and leaving degenerate cases aside, you are looking at three subspaces of variable dimension. Is it still true that you can put them into a fixed normal form? Exactly. See, this is what you use, what sometimes is called the solution of a universal mapping problem. You have any map from a set into a group. Is there a unique group such that such a map corresponds to a group homomorphism from that group? The answer is yes. L is just a functor free group, free abelian group on a set. Right. Now let's do another one. We started with the forgetful functors for quite a while, and we were asking whether these are representable. So, for example, if I take the forgetful functor from the category of rings, two sets. So what do I want? Well, I just have to copy what I had here. I want that all the set maps for sets from any set S into a ring R, maybe I'll just call the ring something else, A. This is a ring, should be equal to the set of homomorphisms of rings from some ring, which I construct out of S, into the given ring A. What does L exist, and if so, what is it? Any second opinion? So you're suggesting we'll take the polynomial ring where the s are the variables and the integers are the coefficients. You agree or not? Non-commutative polynomials, because we didn't say we were in the category of commutative rings. Or how do you call this as well? So L would be? Yeah, the tensor algebra over Z on S. Now here's a trickier one, which you probably only will know if you have ever seen it, but which is very similar in flavor. Let's say we take the category of K algebras. So K is a commutative ring, and so it's a ring, not necessarily commutative, but it's a ring from homomorphism from K into the center of A. And there is a forgetful functor, even though it might not look like it, into K Lie algebras. Namely, if you have such a K algebra, you assign to it the Lie algebra, which is still A as a set, but the bracket between two elements A and B is defined to be AB minus BA. So it's just the commutator of the two elements. So what's the left adjoint?
You don't forget Well, you do, because you see, you only keep part of the multiplicative structure. You forget something about the multiplicative structure. From here, you are no longer able, in general, to reconstruct A times B. No. Yeah, the adjoint, so L, is called the universal enveloping algebra. So what does it mean? Let me write it out for those who have never seen this. So it means that if you take any Lie algebra, G, and you look at the K Lie algebra homomorphisms, from here into A with a bracket, so the underlying Lie algebra of A, that this is the same thing as the homomorphisms of K algebras from the universal enveloping algebra of G into A. Now here's one which is probably more familiar. We take the abelian groups and we forget that we have a commutative group. So we simply take an abelian group and we send it to the same group, but we forget that it was commutative. So what is the, does the left adjoint exist, and what is it? Yeah, that's what's called, L is the abelianization. So it sends a non-commutative group, not necessarily abelian group G, to G modulo its commutative subgroup. So now, and that's perhaps the final example I want to give. Where the functor has both a left and a right adjoint. These are sort of the best things possible. And so to do that, let's assume F from A to B is a ring homomorphism . Then I have a forgetful functor from B modules to A modules, just what's sometimes called restriction of scalars along F. So I'll call it F lower star is a functor from B modules to A modules, and it doesn't really matter whether you take left or right as long as you have the same side both for A and B. So you take a B module N, and you simply, so this is a left B module, and you simply view it as an A module via F. So in other words, A times N is by definition F of A times N. So this is called, this is a forgetful functor because it forgets sort of the structure from B to A, and also is sometimes called restriction of scalars along F. Now I claim there exists a left adjoint F upper star and a right adjoint which is sometimes usually called F upper shriek. What are those? So Let's first write down what it means to have a left adjoint. So, if F star should be the right one, so we want that Hom F star of something, which is M, so this is all A-linear, this should be isomorphic to something over B. So in other words, the A, given an A module M, I'm looking for all homomorphisms, A-linear homomorphisms, from M into N. N viewed as an A module by a restriction of scalars. I ask myself, can I dress up the A module M to a B module so that the A linear maps over here are the same as the B linear maps over there? We've never seen it, we probably won't get it, but just the tensor product, yes. So this is going to be B tensor over A with M. And so, how is this, in this case it's quite instructive, because let's see how this isomorphism works. So if I have an A linear map from here to here, from M to N, what is the morphism I assign on the other side? So I have to say, what is sort of phi tilde of B tensor M over A, what is it doing? Right? Because, I mean, after all, if I have a morphism here, I have to find one over here. So how do I extend it from M to the tensor product? Well, phi of M, by definition, lands in N. And N is a B module, so I know how to multiply with B. Right? Now, what's the inverse? Assume I'm given psi from B tensor A, M to N. This is B linear. How do I make out of this an A-linear map from A to N? Sort of psi, I don't know, psi tilde. So how should I define psi tilde of M? Then I must be able to go backwards as well. Huh? Well, how does M fit inside, quote-unquote, B tensor M of A? Well, I just take the elements 1 tensor M. So I would define this to be psi of 1 tensor M. And now one needs to check that, indeed, these are inverse procedures and that they are natural in N and M, to get that we really have an isomorphism of pi functors. Now, here's the beauty of it. If you have never heard about the tensor product, take this as a definition. The left adjoint to the forgetful functor. Everything else follows from there. Because of this identification, whatever you want to say about the tensor product, you can translate it over here where you don't have to do anything. Sounds too strange? Okay. So that needs perhaps a bit more work, and we will do some more work on this function in particular. Now, what should be the right adjoint? So what do we want now? Well, this time we want F lower star of N on the other side. And because I don't want to take the same M, maybe I'll take L and then I take L here. So N is a B module again, L is an A module. And so I want this to be naturally the same thing as the B morphisms from N to something. Well, of course, that was a really stupid notation, given what I may look at M prime. F upper shriek, M prime. So, this here is nothing but something in here is nothing but an A linear map from N to M prime, keeping in mind that N actually has more structure. It has also a B module structure. So how can I beef up M prime to B module so that this is the same, that I can extend it, keeping into account the B module structure that I already had on N? This is much easier than the other one, even though it gets much less attention. So what's the right adjoint to the forgetful functor? Which B module has this to be here? Now mind you, M prime is an A module. I have somehow to convert it into a B module. On the other side, when I looked for the left adjoint, I did it by the tensor product. Now I want to do it on the other side, on the right side, so I do it through the Hommes. So we'll define F upper shriek of M prime will be Homm from A, B to M prime. Consider it as a B module via this argument. So in other words, if I take a function f in here from b to m prime, then I define b times f of b prime to be f of bb prime. The other is like this. So now one has to prove a few things, right? One, first of all, has to prove, which is easy, this is a B module with this declaration. And also that if I have, that we have this equality up here. So now let's see this. So if we start with phi, as I said here, what should we do on the other side? What should be sort of phi tilde, which is now should be a B linear map from E into Homm A, B, M prime. So given an element N and N, which homomorphism on B should we assign to it? So we need a map from B to M prime, so where should I send B? Well, phi maps N to M prime, so nothing wrong with taking phi of N. And then I want the structure, so I just multiply by B. Now, of course, again, one has to check that this indeed, phi tilde, is a B linear map. How do I go backwards? If I have psi from N into F upper shriek of M prime, in other words, I have a map into this guy. What is psi tilde? Well, I need to do something to an element of N. Originally, such an element of N goes to a map from B to M prime. But I want an element in M prime, not a map. So I just have to evaluate it at the suitable element. Which one should it be? Well, just one, right? So it is psi of N, which is a map, evaluated at one. And again, one simply has to check that these two associations are inverses of each other, and that they are compatible with A linear maps in the covariant argument and with B linear maps in the contravariant one. And so here we have a nice situation where something has both the left and the right adjoint. Now let me assign this as an exercise. Assume, let's say A will take the integers, will take G, your favorite finite group, and I really mean your favorite one, make it small and easy to see what's going on, and set B equal to the group ring over G. Then there is, of course, a canonical ring homomorphism from A to B, and so here's the exercise: show that not only does F star, F lower star, have a left and a right adjoint, but show that each of F lower star, F upper shrink, again has both left and right adjoints. And so forth. In other words, if you have an adjoint, this one has a new another one, it goes on forever on both sides. Yeah. Well, part of it we already did. So you have this triple of functors, and each of them can be adjoined on either side, and you can keep on going. I'm not saying that you get infinitely many new things. And so the second question, so do it for your favorite group. Don't make it too complicated until you understand what's happening. And then the question would be, What is the property of this ring homomorphism, in this case, which makes this possible? Why is it so that you can keep on adjoining? Because normally this is not true. Normally that's what I gave you is the whole thing. There is no, in general, there will be neither a right adjoint to F upper shriek nor a left adjoint to F upper star for arbitrary ring homomorphism. So this is a very special case, and so just try to figure out what's so special about it. Oh, it's just, you see, there's always, for any ring, there's just one homomorphism from the integers to it. Because one has to go to one, right? So this is what we also call the characteristic homomorphism, right? Okay, so and then I would like you to keep your eyes open and during the week until next Monday to think of at least 5 more examples of left and right adjoint functors, because they pop up all over the place. Whenever you have a universal problem to solve, likelihood is, if you can solve it, it's given in terms of adjoint functors. Okay, thank you very much.